Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The actual undercover was worked out of my division, which is why I kind of was on the front line and had a chance to do it. But we were getting calls about just some crazy rhetoric and people in these groups spewing some pretty bad stuff. And what we found out was that the leader and creator of the base, this guy is a U.S. born citizen, former Army intel, Villanova grad, somewhere got radicalized, now resides in St. Petersburg, Russia. So I answer some emails. They said the closest cell to you is in North Georgia. We're driving down there. I meet a case team out of Georgia, and they don't want to lose me, and I don't want them to lose me. They said, hey, man, you mind if we put a tracker on the vehicle? I said, no, go ahead. So I was instructed to drive into Rome, Georgia. I go up, and I'm on a hill. So he goes, oh, okay, I see you. We're coming up. So they walk up, and I know they're going to check me out. He's like, hey, I need you to step out, put your phone on airplane mode. Then he pulls out this wand that I'm like, what the heck is that? So he's wanding it across me, and I'm like, all right, yeah, man, here you go, man. Have at it. He goes in the truck. And I'm thinking, why did he say put it in airplane mode? And he starts working his way to the back of my truck, which is, I don't know where they put it. As he's getting closer to the rear bumper, that thing starts going nuts. It's lighting up and it's getting louder and louder. And I'm like, oh, crap. I don't know if we're going to go to blows. I don't have a weapon on me. I don't know if they do.
All right, guys, we're back for part two of this week's episode with Scott Payne, retired FBI agent. How many years do you have in law enforcement? 28 years. Dang, it's a long time. And if you remember yesterday, first of all, welcome back. Thank you for coming back to hear the second part of this story. I'm going to do my best to get Scott to come out of his little cocoon there because he's kind of shy and bashful here. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, watch yesterday's episode and see what you think. We've been having a good time here. Haven't had this many laughs in an episode in quite a while. So it's the breath of fresh air. It's always fun to have some fun on these shows. But yesterday we were talking about how he infiltrated the Outlaws motorcycle gang up in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, I've been listening to Scott talk. He can say his R's. I don't know how he fit in Boston, but that's part of the undercover persona, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about chowder. You called it something else.
Chowder.
There you go. You got rid of that R. So I guess you're starting to become multilingual.
It's a blessing and a curse. I mirror and I don't even mean to. So if I'm talking to somebody that stutters, I will literally start stuttering. And they'll be like, are you making fun of me? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. I can't help it. If you talk like Elmer Fudd, I will respond to you as Elmer Fudd. I can't help it, man. And I'm sorry.
Well, the time we finish this interview, you'll be talking hillbilly like me.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, I do that too. I get on the phone and then it starts getting worse and where I get that draw, man. I'm like, God.
Well, you haven't been a kid in Tennessee until I was become a teenager. When I moved to West Virginia, I had a strong Tennessee accent. I was light and night and you know, very strong eyes. We all went to school in Tennessee. We didn't go to school. We went to school.
Mm.
And so I get to West Virginia, and these kids, they're tough, man. New kid on the block. And they're making fun of my Tennessee accent. And I'm thinking, have you guys listened to yourselves?
Yeah, I know.
But it all comes around. It's all good.
That's what we call an intervention.
I guess. I almost had one there in the football locker room when I did my first season out for football, but I'm still friends with the guy. That was my first run in with somebody there. Okay, so we've got Scott here infiltrating the Outlaws motorcycle gang. He's living in McAllen. He's actually having to travel to Boston. He's leaving his wife and two daughters down in McAllen. Tough, tough, tough things to do. So, Scott, and how long were you working in the Outlaws?
2 years undercover, yeah.
God bless you. I don't know how you do that. Because, I mean, typically outlaw motorcycle gangs are pretty nasty people.
I agree.
That's
for the most part. When I say they're my people, I don't mean I'm a criminal. I just mean, other than something we're going to talk about here in a minute, most of that was really fun.
Yeah.
For me, I'm like, I'm riding motorcycles. And I'm in my NARC unit that I was in South Carolina. Man, we went to spring and fall bike week in Myrtle Beach. And I got pictures somewhere of us. You wouldn't think anybody was a narcotics law enforcement officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like most investigators that investigate bikers kind of pick up that look.
Yeah. I just always thought it was cool. And I was doing an interview the other day and I totally forgot. I should have put this in the book, but I'd forgotten all about it. When I was a kid, it would have been a relative, but it would have been like a distant cousin or something. Circling back to Spartanburg, he was a member of the motorcycle gang, the Spartans. Now, I was a young kid. I didn't know enough about anything, but I knew as a kid, when we went to the funeral, they didn't wear their colors. They dressed up. And I remember being a kid and seeing all these grown men with goatees and sideburns or beards and long hair with earrings and tats, but they had on a tie and a jacket. I just remember looking as a kid going, whoa, that is a cool look. Even as a kid, like I watched Mr. Rogers and I'm like, but I look over there and I go, yeah. So later on in life, you meet the Undertaker, or I did. As a bouncer in North Charleston. And I remember seeing this dude. He was 6'10", 330, flat-footed, with hardly anybody fat at all. He had just tattooed his forearms at that point. And I was a head bouncer, and we'd take good care of him when they came to the club. And he had his hair pulled back, ponytail, sunglasses right here, sideburns, and a goatee. And I remember I tried to be cool. I tried to play, hey, how's it going? Anything, you let me know. But on the inside, I'm going, oh, my gosh, it's the Undertaker. Oh, my gosh. You know, right?
Fangirling.
Man, I mean, I didn't sleep that night. Me or my roommate, who is the lieutenant over narcotics in Spartanburg County. We were back at the trailer. We were like, oh, my gosh, did you see all the WWE? It was the greatest thing ever. I got goosebumps right now. So I'll fast forward, and then we'll get back to the biker stuff. My mayor is Glenn Jacobs, Kane, who played the storyline that was Undertaker's brother. Yeah, he's a buddy. Unbelievably smart man. Really smart and huge and strong, but smart. So when he's running for mayor, Taker comes out to help do a little fundraiser thing. I end up at the private party with him, and I'm helping with a little crowd control or whatever. Well, my daughter, I guess me and Taker were wearing something similar. Now, I'm only 6'4", maybe 260 at that point, whatever. He's still 6'10", 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And she taps him on the back. She was younger. She says, Dad. Well, he turns around. She was like, oh. So when we leave that night, both of my daughters are like, Dad, the Undertaker reminds us so much of you. And I said, no, girls. Your dad reminds you of the Undertaker. I said, it took me to the night to realize that I've been trying to look like that sucker for the last, since 1993. I'm like, I even got the peekaboo tattoo coming up the neck. I'm like, oh, I'm such a copycat. I'm like Mini Taker, but it's still a cool look. I still love the look. So
that's fine. I had Cody Alford's retired Marine Corps, youngest guy to make E8 in his life, scout sniper with the Marine Corps. Now does motivational things, talking and classes and teaching and mentoring and that kind of things. But he is covered in tats. He's got a couple on his cheek. I met him in person out in San Diego at the Southern California Gang Conference a couple of years ago. And we got to be friends and just had him on the show. And the last question I'm asking him, and I always ask you guys before I don't surprise anybody. I'm not about gotcha moments here on the show. And I wanted to ask him about his tats. And I asked him, I said, man, just what is up with all those tats, man? You got them everywhere. You got your earlobes are tatted. You got them on your face. Now he's got a huge cross when his head shaved all the way back down the back of his head. And he became a Christian here in the last couple of years. So that's where that came from. But his was the same as you. It's just, I like them. I'm not making a statement. I'm not telling anybody they got to do it. This is just what I like.
Yeah. So it's addictive too.
It is. Well, you look at people and they're like, well, why did they spend all that money on all those tats? What is it? If I stood there and looked at their tats, like I'm looking at yours now, what would I learn from that? And what I learned from Cody is it ain't nothing there for me to learn. It's just what he likes.
Okay? Oh, I got some stuff you can learn from. I got hidden stuff all in mine.
Yeah.
I don't think Christian I want to spend daughter's names, all kinds of stuff like that. This whole sleeve, I thought about a sleeve from the start. I knew I wanted the armor of God. But anytime you see armor of God tattoos, for the most part, you see Knights of the Templar or gladiator type stuff. Well, I was doing these neo-Nazi pagan type things, and I've started looking and I'm like, I could still do the armor of God and have like a warrior Viking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to pastor about it. And I'm like, I'm not being sacrilegious. I do like Vikings too. But he's like, no, that's it. So this, my whole arm is all Viking motif, but it's the armor of God to me. Even in my lightning is PS 23, so Psalms 23. And then by the time I retired, I put the Ephesians up my arm. But yeah, all of mine have meaning.
Yep. Yep. All right. And that wasn't even on the list of questions here for you.
Bam. Hour number 52.
There you go. All right. So in the Outlaws, you're working undercover for a total of 2 years, roughly. What was the scariest moment you ever had working with those guys?
About a year and a half in, I've developed all these relationships. We up the ante. So I started as I had a legit job. In other words, what's this country boy doing in Massachusetts?
Mm-hmm.
It's a fair question. Why are you here? What do you do? So I was a site survey specialist for investors. Not really, but that was my story. And I could talk that gab and knew a lot about it. And I could sell it, is what I'm trying to say. And then it eventually starts coming out that, ooh, I'm a criminal as well. Because for the listeners that don't know, they probably should know on this type of podcast, but you have to be predicated. The whole argument against undercovers is they can only do one of two things. Usually the evidence is so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. The only thing they can do is claim entrapment, which if you've done your job, that should not be an issue and you should be able to squash that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can try to make you look like a piece of trash on the stand. And that's pretty much it. But they started with insurance fraud. They would report a vehicle stolen, sell it to me at a stolen price, and they believed I was moving it to Mexico because I was based out of McAllen.
Mm-hmm.
Then it got more and more trust. Then it became, hey, we just carjacked this guy. We got to get rid of this thing. It's hot. I'll take care of it. Then it was, hey, we took this 350 right off the lot. All right, man, I got to be careful. I can't be directing you to go pop steering wheels and stuff and drive me all these nice trucks. But we get to the year and a half point. By this point in time, we've got information about home invasions, extortions, definitely dope. And if you were looking for any predication, as soon as the president of the Taunton chapter, Joe Dogs, found out I was on the border, he goes, where are you at? Where are you from? I said, I live in McAllen, Texas. I'm right there on the border. His next sentence was, how much can you get a kilo of cocaine for down there? And I'm like, well, if we didn't have predication before,
we got
it
now.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was about 11 or 13 grand a key on the border at that time.
Wow.
His math is like, so I could get this many kilos up here for like, no, you don't get them for 11 to 13 grand.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a
transportation
process.
Fee.
Yeah, that's, if you want to drive your ass down to the border and buy it for that and try to get it back, that's on you. But anyway, we upped the ante and we were going to be doing a drug deal, basically a drug protection. And it's a long process. I didn't just spew this stuff out. I would drop breadcrumbs. They were requesting stuff. So eventually we get to the point to where we're the day out from doing the drug deal. Now they don't know that we've really got 40 kilos of real cocaine and 1,000 pounds of real weed. They don't know that, but that's what we had and that's what we're going to do the deal with. So the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI want as much evidence as we can get. You want that airtight case, just like DEA or anybody doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that involves me going into the clubhouse, wired to the hilt, getting recordings of people talking nefarious things. And it was the night before the gig and Joe Dogs told me to come over to the clubhouse. So I head over there and it's basically the beginning of our shift. I get there, knocking on the door. Nobody's coming. It's a weird exchange at the door. Like if you compare it to the baseline of any conversations or interactions we've ever had, it was completely different. But he was like, hey, we're still talking. We're still having church, which is the mandatory weekly meeting for especially 1%er clubs. And I thought, well, why the hell did you tell me to come over? You're the one that told me to come if you're not even ready. I didn't think nothing of it. So I went and grabbed something to eat, a couple of drinks, come back, wait, and then I get into the clubhouse. And what I didn't know is that their whole church meeting was about me and about this deal that was happening the next day. And apparently it had gone all the way up to the national president and came back down that, have you really checked this guy? We found out that they said, hey, I've done like 6 to 8 jobs with this guy. I'm not in handcuffs, which they call bracelets.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's good. Check him anyway. Well, I'm in there wired to the hilt at a year and a half in with these friendships. And the second closest relationship that I thought I had and all the people that I'd befriended or connected with was Clothesline. He was the enforcer, real name Brian De La Vega. And he comes up to me and everybody called me Tex, not very original. I was from Texas. And he said, hey, Tex, you got a minute? And I'm like, yeah. Well, what I couldn't pick up, because I had multiple recording devices on me, But if I'm looking at you, I'm facing you, and this is the bar. So I'm facing you, but I'm leaning this way. So my body's kind of facing this way. I'm cracking jokes like I always do, and then I do the funny laugh, and I get everybody laughing. Well, when I turn and look at you, what I couldn't see is that they were going stone face. They'd be laughing like, ah, and as soon as I turn, it'd be like, right. So they're setting themselves up. You can also see that one of the guys that took me down into the basement is in the back smoking a cigarette. And at first it looks like he's dancing because he's doing it to the beat of the music. He's warming up. That's what he's doing. And I didn't see that. So my friend, clothesline says, hey, Tex, you got a minute? And I said, yeah, I've been in that clubhouse. I don't know how many times. The rules were, if you're not a patch member, you don't touch the door. The door's dead bolted. They got a metal bar across it. Steel frame, I'm pretty sure. So I'm sitting there with a Jack and Coke, and I'm like, yeah, man. And I follow him, and we go in this one door I'd never been in, and it goes down a very tight stairwell into a cross. It's not a basement. That's super generous. I couldn't stand up straight, even though I'm 6'4 with boots on. I was like this, and it's cramped. And I looked for plastic on the floor because I knew this was bad. I didn't see plastic on the floor. I did see rope, and they had brandished their weapons to let me know, hey, you're not free to leave, and we got guns.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me to write down. He said, there's a lot of shit. This are his words exactly. He said, there's a lot of shit going on, and it's my job to protect my brothers. And I said, okay. And he's like, I need you to write down your full name, your address, phone number, everything. He said, I'm not going to ask for your kids' names. It's not like we can't find them if we don't want to. And I need you to take off all your clothes because I'm going to check you for a wire. Well, had I not been wired, it would have just been an embarrassing moment, but I was wired. And we're talking circa 2006, seven. So clearly technology's better now.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the devices I was using, you could probably feel it if you squeezed enough on clothing, right? And I had an adrenaline dump. It was an oh crap moment, multiple actually. It was more like a roller coaster ride. Because of the amount of stress, I forgot my middle name. And if you watch the video, you can see me looking at the sticky note going, and time slows down. For people that have ever had an adrenaline dump, maybe your first car wreck, everything slows down. You get auditory exclusion. Everything you hear is going whoosh, whoosh, really slow. Your eyes, you get time dilation. Everything's like click and screen grabs, click, click. You can hear and feel your heart beating through your whole body. Hamstrings are weak, all that stuff. And I forgot my middle name, and I didn't even know I did it, much like in tactical training where you can show you multiple videos of officers in shootings. They don't know how many rounds they shot. They don't realize that they took effective cover and did a magazine exchange because they've trained till it became instinctive. Some people call it muscle memory. But I was talking, and I was listening to what they were yelling because I was like, what else do you need? I said, my name and what else? Of course, it doesn't sound like this. It sounds like, my name and what else? My voice is way higher. Because of the stress, I'm talking through my nose. I'm not enunciating at all because of the stress. And I hear them yell up, hey, probate, what else do you need for that website? Something like that. And I go, okay, they're going to run me on whosarat.com, which was big back then. They're going to Google search me. And I'm like, okay. So I'm trying to work this out in my head, even though I'm crapping my pants. I'm like, what can I do here? Don't vapor lock. Keep talking. This is supposed to be your boy, and I'm talking, and he's like, hey, man, trust me. If somebody accused me of being a fed, I'd probably smash him in the effing mouth. And I immediately responded, I'm not happy. And he said, I wouldn't be either. And I'm still talking. My words were, if nobody wants to do shit, they ain't got to do shit. And he said, well, let me ask you, wouldn't you be suspect if I came to your town and we started doing all this stuff together? I said, yeah, I might be if you came up to me. But I never came up to you guys. Y'all came to me. You called me over again. If nobody wants to do nothing, they ain't got to do nothing. I'm trying to get out of there is what I'm trying to do. And so I take my boots off. I take all my upper clothing off. I drop my jeans and my underwear down around my ankles. So from the ankle up, butt naked. And he's checking me. And I pass that. And I pull my britches back up. And I'm like, okay. And we're talking. And I'm like, look, man, like I said, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes to grab a piece of clothing. And he says, hey, man, I'm not going to find anything here I don't want to, right? Like some naked pictures of my old lady. And I laughed and I said, yeah, I hope not, because I had nothing to say. And in that piece of clothing he grabbed was a recording device. And he starts kneading it with his hands and going up it. And again, I don't know how I do it, but I've seen the video so many times showing it in teaching environments. I'm like, you can hear me go, because I'm watching it. I mean, what am I going to do? Even if I try to fight, You got two armed dudes. One of them still on the steps with his pistol right there in his waistband so I can see it. Even if I get past those guys, I've got, what, 10 to 12 more outlaws upstairs with a barricaded door, basically, because it's got a steel bar across it. So as I'm watching, he looks right at it. I can't tell if he sees it, but if I play the video, it's a quick, and I pass. And as soon as that happens, I go right into my joking, because it's also not just me, it's a self-defense mechanism. And I'm like, well, can you at least give me a hug? I'm like, it's a good thing I didn't wear white underwear or whatever I said. I'm glad I'm wearing colored boxers or whatever I said. But he's like, yeah, it's scary. I said, well, I didn't see plastic on the floor. I said, if I'd have seen that, I probably would have tried to fight my way out. And I went right into business. So we get to the point that night where I'm handing off my equipment. And by then, my adrenaline's now like, bah! And then we go out drinking with Joe Dogs and Big Scott. And I took it personal. I shouldn't take it personal. I know I'm an undercover, but I took that personal. I'm like, who in the F do you think you are taking me down in the basement? But then in my other side of my mind, I'm going, well, I am undercover against you, and you were trying to find the undercover. But still,
right?
I'm supposed to be your friend. You're pissing me off. And I'm cussing at him at a bar. Joe Dogs is like, look, man, people are freaking out because there's a lot at risk here. I said, yes, there's a lot at risk, Joe, because what we're doing is effing illegal. I'm like, if it wasn't illegal, there would be no risk. And again, you asked for this. Y'all been begging me and pounding the door, telling me to introduce you to these people. Here we are. If you don't want it, nobody's got to do it. I said, but I'm going to tell you what. Y'all show up tomorrow. You know what? I don't care how cold it is. Maybe I'll just strip every one of you in the parking lot. Let's see how you look when you're naked and it's cold. But that night, I go to hand off my equipment. And what everybody always asks is, man, what would you have said had he found something? I had two responses. Number one would have been a joke because he gave me the bone. He threw the bone to me. If he would have said, what is this? I would have said, I don't know, some naked pictures of your old lady. Maybe try to laugh it off. The only other thing I had to say, Steve, was, look, man, the gig is up. I'm an undercover FBI agent, and I can walk out of this clubhouse and we can see each other in court, or all hell's going to break loose. But that would have been a bluff on my part, because as far as I knew, every time I'd been in that clubhouse, they really couldn't hear me that good. Whether it was the equipment, walls, whatever it was, they can never hear me that good. So I knew I was kind of flying solo, which even if they can hear me, you know this. I'm not saying to be morbid and be the glass is half empty guy or gal, but if the crap's going to hit the fan, even if there's two SWAT teams on the other side of that door, it could be over before they even breach the door, before they even turn the doorknob. I've got videos, 8 shots. Dude walks in, pow, 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 8 of them off before they can even get through a door. So you got to be prepared for that. But that night when I handed off my equipment, they had heard everything. The task force officers that were working that case, Joe Cummings, detective out of Brockton PD, Sergeant Higginbotham, Massachusetts State Trooper, whatever that first exchange was with Joe Dogs made their spidey senses go off. And they were like, something's not right. They had gotten close enough to hear everything. I didn't know that. And from what they told me, they radioed back to Boston and they're like, hey, they got Scott in the basement and they're stripping him and he's wired. So from what Wade was explaining to me is everybody was coming blue lights and sirens down the highway. And kind of a very vulnerable, touching part in the story is I'd bought my wife a burner phone. We were newly married pretty much. We were then 5 years. I had 2 daughters. One's 3 and one's around 1. And I would call her no matter what time I got off, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, 7 in the morning, just to let her know, hey, babe, I'm okay. I'm headed back to the hotel. I'll call you when I wake up later today. And usually it was really quick. Okay, love you, love you. Sometimes she'd talk till I got back to the hotel. That night when I called her, the first thing she said was, are you okay? And I said, yeah, why? And she said, I don't know. I was driving our daughters around in McAllen at such and such time tonight, and I just got this overwhelming feeling. And she pulled over on the side of the road and started praying for me. And I matched it up. And it's when I was in the basement getting stripped at gunpoint.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So pretty crazy.
I tell you what, just you telling a story, you see my stretch of my neck. I'm stressing out here just listening. Imagine what you're going through down there.
Well, I'm going to tell you, the first umpteen times I watched that video, I'd get butterflies. And this is a kind of comical side because I'm a jokester as well. But as I've said, I don't know how many times I watched that video until it finally hit me. The entire time I'm in that clubhouse and they bring me down to strip me, there was one song playing loud over the stereo system in the clubhouse. and it was Lynyrd Skynyrd, Give Me Three Steps. The whole song is about getting out. The whole song is about being in the wrong place. And if you give me three steps, you'll never see me no more. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, man, you think Van Zandt was sending me a message from the grave? I just joke a little bit, but I'm a believer. So I say it like this. I said, I'm over there going, Lord, if I'm not supposed to go in there, if you just give me a sign, won't you give me three steps? Hey, yeah. Could you turn that radio down? I'm trying to talk to Jesus over here. You know,
and your sign is.
He's sending me the sign the whole time, you idiot. What do you mean do? Paint it on the wall for you? But yeah, it was a crazy time. Man. And then we pulled it off. I lived to fight another day. We did the deal the next day. Huge success. Nobody ripped us. Can you imagine 40 kilos getting? I don't know what happened.
Yes. Plain to do after something like that.
Snipers on the roof, whole nine yards. And then.
That kind of led, though, to crash for you, didn't it?
Kind of. So I talk about it thoroughly in the book. And when I go and speak and teach, some people, they hear the story and they go, oh, man, Scott got stripped at gunpoint and he nutted out. That's not even close to what happened. I took the warrior mentality and applied it to every aspect of my life. I think the warrior mentality is imperative to doing what we did and do for a living. But if you apply it to every scenario of your life, every aspect, it can be very detrimental. At least it was for me. So not only am I working a couple of undercovers at the same time, I'm a senior case agent on the squad in McAllen, Texas. I'm the principal relief supervisor, which means you're in the batter's box if the supervisor's not there. You're the lead one.
That sucks.
So you're going to run the squad on the border with like four extortion kidnappings every week and everything else that's going on. And I was the lead firearms and tactics instructor. I put on all the training for the McAllen RA and the Brownsville RAs. I was on the SWAT team. And at a certain point, if you look, our old inspection process was like, they looked at you as an agent for the last 3 years. I really wish the FBI went back to it. If they have already, great. If not, I hope they do. Because it really looks at you as an individual. What have you done in the last 3 years working for the Bureau? And if you looked at that, they always looked at the top 10 cases in the last 3 years, the top 10 sources in the last 3 years. I had the majority of the top 10 cases. I had the majority of the top 10 sources. I never stopped working. And my MO was always to try to be above the average on the squad. There was a time or maybe two in the Bureau where the average was so freaking high because everybody on the squad was a heavy hitter. You just wanted to maintain average. Mm-hmm. But it was also a way for me, in my mind, if I was above average on my sources, my cases, producing for the squad, then management wouldn't be able to say, no, you can't do that undercover, or no, you can't go on that SWAT call out or run that SWAT school. And that was my MO. And it burnt me out. For a three-year period, I was going pretty hard. And by the end, getting towards the end of the outlaw case, I was a zombie, man. I was taking ephedrine. I was taking it. I was on antihistamines, decongestants, inhalers. I'd get on a plane in McAllen, get off in Boston, I'd have a sinus infection. I was that worn down. Jeez. And I was a zombie at home. I didn't know it until we really did the book process, but I even learned then. I knew things were messed up, but my wife kind of painted the picture for me is that I was a ghost at home. Like when I got home, I was so beat from all the training and traveling and everything. I would veg, I would rock my girls and we'd watch a little TV. But even if my wife came up to ask me a question about a bill or something, hey, can I ask you? I'm like, I can't even think. So she was just trying to keep peace and keep pressure off of me. But I eventually crashed. I got to a point to where I was lying on our psychological assessment forms and I knew it was messed up. I'm like, I can't remember how to relax. What's the last thing you did to relax? Last time I relaxed, and you complete the sentence, I had nothing. And I knew that was messed up because my minor psychology, but I just went, popped it off. I go, that's really messed up. Let me make up a story. And I came back from Daytona Bike Week and I was asleep on the plane, wheels up to wheels down to Houston. Wheels up to wheels down to McAllen, and that never happened to me. And I got home, and I slept probably close to 20 hours the first day, maybe 18 the second day. But for a five-day period, I slept over 16 hours a day, and I wasn't depressed. I wasn't sick. I know what they both feel like. I was just that daggum tired. And nobody, I did it to myself. All those positions I made, only thing I was required to be for the FBI was a case agent. Mm-hmm. All the undercover, SWAT, firearms, tactics, all that stuff is collateral duties. Principal release, all collateral duties. And I applied for them and I met my threshold. I think your threshold changes all the time, but I met mine. I crashed. They came in and did an on-site assessment. The safeguard unit we have, which is for psychologically assessing active undercovers, and they use them for a bunch of other stuff now too. But I was diagnosed as over-assigned, and I got put on timeout. It's called DNR, just do not recommend. So when they're assessing you, they're like, it might be the beginning of a case, the middle of a case, or the end of a case. And if they put DNR, that means they do not recommend you to go back on that case or any undercovers until you can get your stuff straight. And that's what happened.
How long did that last?
It's a minimum of 6 months. I did get to finish the outlaw case on the phone. We had a couple of stragglers there at the end. One in particular named Tim Sylvia, not the UFC fighter Tim Sylvia. That is a friend of mine. Same name, two different dudes.
Yeah.
But this Tim Sylvia is, by that time in his life, he'd spent more time in jail than he had out. And he had met me through one of the outlaws before I had my crash. And then he called me because my story was, is they knew I'd gotten married. I told him, look, I'm getting a divorce, but I got to relocate my wife and kids to El Paso. I got to get this place sold. I said all this story, and I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror if I didn't get my kids to the right spot. But as soon as they're in El Paso, I'm coming to Massachusetts. Screw this hot weather kind of thing. And he called me up, wanted me to sell him. He said if I could get him kilos at 18 grand a piece, he had enough to buy 10 right then and there. But he also had some stolen vehicles or some he wanted to report stolen. So I called the case team, said, hey, do you want me to set this up? And they said, yes. So two of the guys that were posing as truck drivers for me, really one of them was a driver. The other one just stayed in the passenger seat. I mean, he didn't have a CDL, I don't think. And when they went to go pick up the vehicles from Tim, even if you watch the recording, they call me. You can hear me on the phone, clear as day. They put me on with Tim. Tim said he was going to report the BMW stolen on a Friday. I said, make it Saturday if you can. It gives me 24 hours to get the thing in Mexico, and then we ain't got to worry about nothing. And then the other undercover posing as a truck driver gets back on with me, and he says, I go, hey, Tex, how much do I pay him? I said, for those vehicles, he gets 21 grand. And they're like, okay. And then when they went to load up the vehicles, he hit them for the 10 kilos at 18 apiece. And they set it up, and that was the reversal. They did one more visit just to kind of, I think, to tighten things up for the United States Attorney's Office. And then that was the takedown. They showed up. He showed up to get 10 kilos, and it was reversal, and they took it all down from there.
Jeez. I've got so many cases lined up here that I got out of the book. I mean, we just don't have time to go through all of them. But the next thing that you moved to Knoxville, I think you said, yeah. And there was, I'm going to debate the audience here because you got to check out this book. There's one called Operation Poetic Justice, where you became the Marlboro Man selling hillbilly heroin.
Yeah, stolen cigarettes, and that was the break of the opioid epidemic when everybody was going to Florida, Broward County specifically.
That
was back in the day when nobody was keeping track of doctors, and Carlo would leave from here, go down there, go to the doctor's office, get the script for cash under the same roof as the pharmacy, fill the script, drive down the road, go to another doctor. They hit three or four doctors before they even came back to town.
The famous pain clinics down there.
There you go, man.
Yeah, and then you did some stuff in South Carolina with a guy named Benji McDowell.
Yeah.
You ended up infiltrating the KKK, and I think you became a member.
Yep, in Alabama, yep. I passed my K-Uno test. I was naturalized and passed the K-Uno test.
Oh, geez. And then you did a lot of murder for hire cases. But the one that I really want to talk to and probably just spend the rest of the time here talking about it is you infiltrated a group called The Base.
Yeah. Scary.
That's exactly. You just took the words out of my mouth. And there's a section in the book here where an agent is testifying before Congress. And I'm looking for the agent's name. I'm not seeing it. Anyway, he said, today I draw four main conclusions. First, both Al-Qaeda and the so-called Islamic State remain potent threats. Second, in addition to the jihadi challenge, we now face clear danger from white supremacist extremism. Third, there are important similarities between these two groups of extremists. But fourth, under its current approach, the U.S. government is at a clear disadvantage when it comes to combating white supremacy. And then he says, Al-Qaeda, that translates to The Base.
Yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
He's comparing this supremacist, this, what do you call them, the accelerationist.
Accelerationist.
I had never heard of that until I read your book. Just tell us what that is briefly.
Me neither, until I infiltrated them and they taught me. I'm like, what is an accelerationist? So there's a book called Siege. Don't go get it. You'll probably be flagged. Unless you want to be, hey, you got that book called The Red Turner Diaries? Everybody comes in, which was the Bible for Timothy McVeigh, for those that don't know. So there's a book called Siege written by James Mason. James Mason's a longtime white supremacist. He creates a group called Adam Waffen. Well, essentially, the book Siege is a bunch of different articles and interviews that he's compiled together. But this dude idolized Charles Manson. And when you hear siege culture, that kind of thing, that's where the accelerationist comes in. The idea of accelerationism was kind of around in the 80s with like the order and stuff like that, but they didn't call it that. Mm-hmm. But picture like doomsday preppers slash militia combining with white supremacy. And that's kind of what you're getting. They are training. Now, am I going to tell you there's a million neo-Nazis going to show up on your doorstep tomorrow? Absolutely not. But for people that try to downplay it, I'll ask, how many is too many deaths? Because I think one's too many.
Absolutely.
Well, they only killed a couple of people. It's not like they killed thousands. Well, what if that couple of people was your wife, your mm-hmm. partner, your kid? And that's the big battle. That's the big battle with domestic terrorism, because almost all the stuff that you see being spewed online falls under First Amendment protected speech. And there is no DT statute federally to charge somebody like on the IT side. You can do like material support or something like that. They don't have that on the domestic terrorism side. So you got to get them with just normal crimes, whether that be harboring an alien or a civil rights issue or a hate crime or something, things like that. So in a nutshell, Siege is kind of the Bible. But the accelerationist view is this. They do not believe that there's a political solution to save the white race. They believe that society is going to collapse either on its own or from man-made events, and they want to speed that up, hence accelerate it. But you're not going to see an accelerationist out there picketing on the side of the street like your Charlottesville and other things like that. They believe, number one, that makes them a mark. Number two, it's not helpful at all. They would rather create chaos through guerrilla warfare tactics, like poisoning a water system, taking down a power supply, murdering lefty journalists or Antifa or non-whites, especially Jewish and neo-Nazis. They hate Jewish people. And they want to do that kind of guerrilla warfare to destabilize society. Now, mm-hmm. for those skeptics out there that are going, there's not a lot of forethought or afterthought. Like in the base, when I was in it, we had one group of us, a couple of cells, C-E-L-L, which also models Al-Qaeda. If you look at Al-Qaeda, it was 3 to 5 man cells all over the world waiting for that training, waiting for that D-Day call. The base, which stands for Al-Qaeda in Arabic, 3 to 5 man cells all over the world, wow. Training, waiting for D-Day. I mean, we had members in Australia, UK, Norway, South Africa, Canada, New Zealand, and of course, America. Mm-hmm. And it ebbs and flows. But because you have a phone, and you have the internet and all these dark web apps and stuff, you can make the world this small real quick.
Yeah.
So we infiltrate those groups and we started learning more. And eventually we uncovered numerous murder plots. But what I was going to say is like a couple of cells, like the Baltimore cell, the North Georgia cell, which I was a part of, we're looking at property in the Appalachian Mountains to take over and create our own compound. The Detroit and Midwest, they were all looking at land up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to create a compound. The Pacific Northwest had land, and they were looking to set up a compound. Again, not a lot of afterthought, because I'm like, well, what are you going to do when the cops show up? Blah, blah, blah. How about the National Guard? Blah, blah, blah. How about the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines? Man, what are you going to do? You think we're just going to be able to take over? But there was that belief system. What you really start finding when you scratch at the surface is usually in most of your accelerationist groups, there's a member of O9A or something like that. O9A is Order of Nine Angles. It's an extremist view, but it's satanic. Mm. So if you thought white supremacy was bad enough, now tie in Satanism, and they are actively pushing rape, sexual abuse, pedophilia, self-harm. So that group 764, which now is making a lot of rounds, and they're open. Apparently they're reporting, I'm not in the FBI anymore, that there's a 764 case open in every field office. When I first heard it, I thought 764 was just human trafficking stuff. Well, after putting on training last week with a guy who's on a task force, he starts talking about it. I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. That sounds an awful lot of accelerationism. And he goes, yeah. I go, these are extremists that are doing this 764 stuff? And he's like, yes. And I go, is there a satanic realm? He said, absolutely. I said, okay. And he said, yes. Man, that is horrific what they're doing. These guys are going online. They're hitting kids and teens, tweens, right? They're hitting them on Roblox, which is a game, Minecraft, Discord, all these Telegram, all these things, and they're grooming them. And then they'll get them on something, and they can even use AI to make a picture of them having sexual acts, and even though it's not them, and start sextorting them and extorting them. They've got people that are committing suicides live online, streaming it. There's a part of like 764, like if you get somebody to hurt themselves more on camera in these watch groups, you get like, I don't know, credit. Like you're climbing up in your credibility and rank. They have them cut themselves. They call it bean. So like if you cut into the fat and separate it, it looks like a white navy bean. They call it that. It's some of the sickest stuff.
Jeez.
Animal cruelty. They've got, like I said, people commit suicide. And most of it's boys. Sexual acts, self-harm, cutting themselves, all that just for viewers. But again, it is extremist view. It's got a satanic angle to it, and it is not good at all, man. Not good at all. And in our world, FBI, DT world, I guess HSI probably can work it a little bit too, but you're looking at that barrel. Let's just say we got a barrel of fish, and let's say that's thousands of posts. You're in a group with 50 people, 100 people. You're on Terror Wave or whatever's out there now. It might be on Riot, Telegram, Threema. There was a 4chan, 8chan, 12chan, Discord, all these that are out there. Or it could just be a regular video game like Roblox or Minecraft. You're looking at all this and you're going, okay, which one is the next Charleston shooter? Which one is the next Christchurch shooter? Which one is the next Tree of Life shooter? And how do we get that? And how do we stop them? And a lot of people don't understand. They're like, why can't you go do that? I was like, the law didn't let us. You can walk out in the middle of the street right now and say, I hate any racial slur you want to say. I hope all racial slurs die. That's not illegal. Now, let's look at the riots that are going on right now. Peaceful protests technically aren't illegal unless you start blocking traffic and this, that, and the other. But setting fires, throwing bricks at people's heads, that's a deadly force issue. Mm-hmm. So the same thing. If you start taking steps in furtherance of, acts in furtherance of a crime, then that's when we can step in. I've been in many groups for 5 months, thousands upon thousands of posts. I didn't miss a single one for five or more months because I didn't want anything to happen bad on my watch. I would rewind back and go through thousands of posts. And after 5 months, I'm like, they're spewing hate. They're a bunch of idiots, but they're not going to pull the trigger. They're waiting. They're training, but they're waiting for D-Day to happen, and then they'll do it.
I mean, scary stuff here. People, I think the average American has no clue.
I don't think so. And that's a big block I teach now. I go, and again, not a chest beating thing. There's haters out there. They'll say, all you want to do is talk about yourself. If that's what you got to tell yourself, cool, man. You do you, I'm doing me. I've always been an instructor and a speaker. So it was when I crashed with the outlaw thing, it was Joe Pistone and some other gurus that called me, and my nickname was Big Country. And they'd be like, hey, Country, how you doing? And I'd say, I'm okay, boss, man. I'm doing better. Hey, take care of yourself, take care of your family, but as soon as you can, put pen to paper about everything you've learned through this, good and bad, because that's how we train. That's how we stop things like this from happening. And that's how we get our best blocks of instruction that have the best impact. And they were right. So as things went on, like when I started finding out about all this, when I went to JTTF for like the last 6 or so years of my career, I started learning about all this and I would go to trainings and nobody knew. So I started putting it together. I'm not saying I'm be all end all. Just make sure you spread knowledge is my big thing.
Right.
Don't wait till, because this happened in real life. Something happened with one of my kids. They got into a little snafu on Snapchat. I went in the work mode. I went into a room. I had a bottle of Jack and a Coke. And I told my wife, I'll see you when I see you. I got notepads. I start diving through phones. I'm start working and I uncovered a group of 7th graders to 11th graders doing some pretty bad stuff on Snapchat. I brought it to the attention of the school. We did what we had to do. I go to the office. I'm being vulnerable and transparent like I am here. I'm talking to the cyber squad, everybody on the cyber squad, task force officers and all. No, man, Snapchat's the devil for kids. And I'm like, see, that would have been good to know 3 months ago, you jackass. Like, what? Why are you not spreading this knowledge? I don't know this. Why would you not spread this in the office? Yeah. Hey, send it in an email. That's how we learn. Yeah, that's how we learn. So anyway, now I'm getting passionate. Now I'm ready to start running around the block here.
That's all right. That's all right. We've all got our hot buttons. I get that way over legalization. So you deal with these white supremacists down there. I mean, the first time that you went to meet them, tell us how that went, where they took you over to a remote. Well, first of all, you were under some power lines, but then they took you to a different location. Yeah.
You think you get wiser. And I'm like, nah, I don't know if I'm just not wiser. I've just got this kind of luck, man.
Well, I think it's kind of surprising that these guys have that forethought to do what you're getting ready to tell us.
Yeah, right. So let's just say, I'll give you a little preface. We started finding out about the base kind of from World Working Groups. I don't know who had the case first because I came in after the fact. But Seattle, Washington had a case. They ended up running the whole thing under the umbrella. The actual undercover was worked out of my division, which is why I kind of was on the front line and had a chance to do it. But we were getting calls about just some crazy rhetoric and people in these groups. And everybody goes by moniker. It might be TMB, the Militant Buddhist, Pestilence, Roman Wolf, Norman Spears, all this stuff. And there were some people, I mean, spewing some pretty bad stuff. And then overseas was looking at their people, but it turns out the base of it, pardon the pun, was in the States. And what we found out was that the leader and creator of the base, even though he says he's not a leader and they say there's no leaders, that's complete BS. I was in the group. He's the leader. As the light shines when he walks through the room.
There you go.
We're all equal here. Yes, your master. You're the leader. This guy is a U.S.-born citizen, former Army intel, Villanova grad, somewhere got radicalized. Now resides, by the time I was doing the case, resides in St. Petersburg, Russia, married to a Russian woman, Russian kids, and supposedly only teaches English. And got a pretty significant amount of money tracked going through his account. And I'm thinking, maybe I need to go to St. Petersburg and teach English.
Yeah.
I don't like vodka that much, but I mean, we can hang. We can figure something out, right? But this is the guy that's leading the base. This is the guy that does my interview. I start answering. They were always recruiting. And I'll see if I can hit one up there. I got a sign somewhere. Protect your race. Save your race. Join the base. And you might see flyers everywhere, and they'd have a QR code. It got more advanced the more we did recruiting. And if we got infiltrated and somebody got doxxed, which is the left outing you, and now everybody knows you're a white supremacist and all this stuff, you lose your job, your family. They're really good. The far left is really good about showing up and protesting. I don't know who the hell pays for it, but they'll show up at your kid's school, your wife's business, your home, and just dox the crap out of you. But hate begets hate. Because while they're doing that, and the far right's losing their livelihood, at some point, everybody's getting together and going, how many of our brothers have to fall until we retaliate against these, whatever they want to call them? And then they're talking about killing them. So that hate begets hate, man. It's just evil. Somebody's whispering in this ear, hey, you see what they're doing over there? Did you hear what they said about you? What are you going to do about it? And then the same evil walks over here and goes, oh, did you hear what the other side said? And next thing you know, you got a full-blown evil war going on. But we found out about these people, and I answer, they were on Gab, so I answer some emails. For about a week, I'm going back and forth on emails. I'm starting to figure out that the times the emails are coming to me, I'm like, this looks a lot like the time in Russia, like you just got off of work, and yet, so we were thinking it was our guy. And then I was instructed to download the Wire app, which is similar to like WhatsApp or something. You can do phone calls on it and stuff like that. It's supposed to be encrypted, out of the country, harder for feds to get, or impossible for feds to get subpoenas to. So I did like a 5-person panel interview for about an hour and 15 minutes. I pass. And then they say, where are you at? I said, East Tennessee. They said the closest cell, C-E-L-L for my country accent, the closest cell to you is in North Georgia.
I understand what you said. Cell. You said it right, I thought.
Yeah, I know, right? It depends on which podcast I'm on, right?
Gotcha.
What are you selling? No, I said sell.
And I understand.
I know, but like, what are you selling? No, I'm not selling nothing. I'm in a sale. Yeah, I know, right? I said, I'm in East Tennessee. They said, your closest cell is North Georgia. Had no idea. One of the biggest complaints coming from people online and stuff about somebody talking crazy was TMB, the militant Buddhist. Guess who ends up being the cell leader? TMB. Mm. And I'm like, boy, if that ain't some luck or divine intervention, you pick which one you want. So we're not even, none of us even know what he looks like. We're driving down there. I meet a case team out of Georgia who, oddly enough, pinpointed, they go, meet us here. So they drop a pin to me. I pull in, it's a cemetery. And I'm like, are you guys trying to tell me something?
That's just an omen.
I know, right? First time I'm meeting you, we're at the back of a cemetery. I don't know, man. I'm going to turn around, head on back to Tennessee. Y'all have a good time. I'm not your guy. But we didn't know where we were going. Weather was getting bad. So you're losing the ceiling for any kind of aerial surveillance because the clouds and the rain. And they don't want to lose me, and I don't want them to lose me. They said, hey, man, can we put a tracker on the vehicle? I said, no, go ahead. So I was instructed to drive into Rome, Georgia, take a picture of, oddly enough, there's a statue of the Roman Wolf there, which was the moniker that the leader of the base used, Roman Wolf. I don't know if there's a tie there or not, but I take a picture of that, park in this certain parking lot, let them know when I'm there. And I remember somebody was like, hey, you think they're going to be watching? I go, yes, they're watching. That's why they told me to park in this spot. Where they, I don't know how many are watching me, but yeah, that's why they tell me to. I mean, that's what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
So take the picture, send it. I couldn't find the parking spot in the lot they wanted me to park at. So I go up and I'm on a hill. It's a pretty steep hill, but I'm behind like a coffee shop. And I send a picture and I go, hey, man, at that point I was White Warrior. I'm like, hey, it's White Warrior. I'm over here behind this place. And he goes, oh, okay, I see you. We're coming up. Well, here comes TMB. He's probably about 6'1", 6'2", maybe like 230. And then Pestilence is with him. And Pestilence is probably like maybe about 180 pounds, maybe like a 5'10 guy. Total goth look, though. Shaved sides, but hair on top, long ponytail down to probably mid-back to butt, and has a tank top on of like a death metal band into black BDUs blast into his 8-inch tactical boots. Typical kind of a goth kind of a death metal look. So they walk up, and I know they're going to check me. I mean, if they're doing their wherewithal, they're going to check me, especially after everything I've gone through just to get to this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, hey, I need you to step out, put your phone on airplane mode. I'm like, cool, man. And then he pulls out this wand that I'm like, what the heck is that? I mean, I'm not rusty. I'm still in the game, but I've never seen anything like that. It looked like a Geiger counter, man. It was about this big, had like a triangle card in it, lights all over it, color coded. And I'm like, so he's wanding it across me. I've had it, you know, wand me. All right, spin around. Cool. He goes in the truck and I'm watching. And I'm thinking, why did he say put it in airplane mode? And I'm thinking, oh, no. And he starts working his way to the back of my truck, which is, I don't know where they put it, but I did see them go under the rear of my truck to put the tractor. As he's getting closer to the rear bumper, that thing starts going nuts. It's lighting up and it's getting louder and louder. And I'm like, oh, crap. This thing picks up the tractor, whether it's cell or whatever it is. I'm like, crap. And cellular, I should say. So I dropped I even dropped my right foot back. I'm like, this is going to be fast. I'm like, if they find this thing, I don't know if we're going to go to blows. I don't have a weapon on me. I don't know if they do. And right when it's really making the noises, Pestilence says, hey, you think it could be the power lines? Because again, we're on a hill. So right at that part of the hill, the telephone pole is kind of short and the wires are kind of coming in like this. So at that crease, at the V point, it's pretty close. So he says, man, let me check. He walks over and it goes ballistic. And he's like, man, whatever he cuss word he throws out, it's the power line. So he says, hey, follow us. So now I'm on my phone because I don't know how many people are following. I'm on my phone as I'm driving and I've got it down here. I'm calling the cover team. I'm like, can you hear me? And they're like, yeah. And I go, you got to shut the tracker off. And they're like, what? I said, shut it off. Now I'm taking my drink and I'm going, because I don't know how many people are watching. I pull my coffee cup up like this. I said, take the dadgum tracker. And it's not like we were a super arguing. They were just concerned. Number one, could they shut it off remotely? If they did, could they get it back on? And I basically, my final command was, look, if you don't shut it off, this is going to be the quickest undercovers I've done, especially like deep. Mm-hmm. Basically doing a buy bust is what's going to happen.
Right, right.
And they got it off. And when we pulled into it looked like a cement plant abandoned, and I'm thinking like a concrete plant. And I'm like, again, my sense of humor, I'm looking up and I'm going, that's funny. Like how many people have died in movies at an abandoned concrete plant that I've seen? I'm like, the hits just keep coming, man. But they got it shut off. They checked and they didn't find it. And then we go to a 100-acre property, which was TMB's dad. And there was a barn and a house on it. That's it. They converted the barn to a living space above. And it was a gorgeous property, man. Gorgeous. It's just sad what all was happening on it.
Yeah. And just for sake of time, what were the final results? Did anybody go to jail and all the things you did? And folks, I'm just doing this out of sake of time because this is a long story. You've got to get the book. And he goes into significant detail to you get a, I can picture things as I read. And you can almost put yourself in the scenario. You'll find out what he went through. But the ultimate results of the case were.
Yeah. So the long and short of it is I gained more trust and more trust. And we started uncovering multiple murder plots. The crew up in Baltimore area, we're looking at taking out cops. They had one of them had a 6.5 Creedmoor. He bought a $6,000 thermal scope to go on it. So maybe at night a cop stops somebody, they pop that cop. That automatically gives them bullets, guns, bulletproof vests to help build your kit up. Because it was all about building your kit for the Boogaloo D-Day. Mm-hmm. And we uncovered that they were going to go to a Virginia guns rights rally. The idea for them was to pop off rounds because it's going to be three percenters, militia, protesters, cops. And maybe if they fired a few rounds and took out some people, nobody knows who's shooting. Everybody starts shooting at each other. Chaos kind of set off the downfall of society. So they're thinking. In the Georgia cell, we uncovered several murder plots. They had already started making a list of left journalists, people involved with Antifa, and they had picked what they believed were an Antifa couple, a couple of counties over. And we cased that place. I mean, they bought catch bags to catch, like, attached to an AR. So if you did shoot, it would catch the brass so you didn't leave anything. I mean, they went into great detail for planning this thing. And we did some crazy hate camps where they stole a goat, sacrificed it at a pagan ritual. We drank its blood. Most of the people did acid, carried the head around with us for 3 or 4 days, training firearms, tactics, hand-to-hand combat, living off the land, all that stuff. And we cased that place several times to murder this family, even if they had kids or dogs or whatever, didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to burn the house down. So we were able to line everything up and time it to where we could take down the Georgia crew. Kept that very hush-hush on a Wednesday, and then Thursday morning, SWAT teams from the FBI hit the members up in the Baltimore, in Delaware areas, and then there were several others that got arrested, and that was it. We took everybody down. Everybody pled guilty.
Is the band still in existence today?
Ronaldo Nazario is Roman Wolf, Norman Spears. He still pops up there trying to get the band back together, but for the most part, it's defunct. The ideology is not. And when we started that case, it was on the fringe, but they considered it cringe to be an accelerationist. But by the time, let's just say a year or two after we took down that case in January of 2020, because I retired in June of 21, somewhere in 2020-ish, if you went into these online groups and you looked at the white nationalists, 90% or more were accelerationists. So extremist views, if you go radical jihad, it ends with a caliphate. If you go radical left, black separatists, it ends with their own stuff. If you go far right, it's what we've explained here. But extremism is very, very similar. Hmm. It's very similar in how it ends and how they're recruited and how they're radicalized. But a lot of these guys, some of them were young. They popped a guy after the case went down over in the UK, 13 years old. They have a DT, a domestic terrorism statute. They charged that kid. He was a member of the base. They said it was like the youngest to ever be charged.
Jeez, at 13.
Yeah. And we had like 40-somethings in our group too. But what I saw a lot of is kids that have probably been bullied, outcast from society, can't get a partner, and they sit on their phone all night in their bedroom and dive down a rabbit hole of hate and get radicalized online.
I know
but I will tell you, one thing I'll say is a 19-year-old kid, you already heard me say about tactical training and the stuff I did. A 19-year-old kid led our firearms and tactics training, and it was not bad. It was good. Wow. And that kid was not military. He did go to a range or a hunting club or something with his dad and maybe gaming. It's just there's so much stuff going on that parents don't even realize. Or cops. I'm like, dude, how can you? I'm 54. I still game. You call me a nerd or whatever you want, but I'm like, dude, Rainbow Six Siege, Call of Duty, Battlefield, all those are so freaking realistic. Mm-hmm. You get on there, if you do the open mic and you're talking, there'll be a kid on the other end telling you to drive the hard corner, slice the pie. And you're like, but the big difference is in the game world, if you die, you can respawn.
Yeah.
In the real world, there's no respawning.
Exactly. Throughout your book, you're promoting faith, hope, and love to overcome hate.
Yeah.
Which I agree with you 100% straight out of the Bible. That's the book I go to. That's the book of instructions there, everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to cut this short, but when you left the FBI, there was a Rolling Stone article that came out and referred to you as the hillbilly Donnie Brasco.
I tell
you what, man, anybody compare me to Joe Pistone, I would take that as a crown of honor.
I didn't. I text Joe and I said, boss man, because he hit me up when the book stuff came out and I got Joe Rogan. He was like, how in the H-E double sticks did you get Joe Rogan? I said, boss man, I don't know, divine intervention. But I told him, I said, by the way, when you hear hillbilly Donnie Brasco, I want you to know I had absolutely zero to do with that. I would never take your title. I said, I just want you to know that from me to you. Yeah. And I said, but I will try to do it justice. And he hit me back with the sunglasses emoji, like the cool emoji. He said, I like it. And I went, well, if you say it's okay, then I guess it's okay.
Yeah. He's a real gentleman. It's funny because the very first time we ever met him was at the Southern California Game Conference. And Mel and Santi took us all to dinner. We're right there at the hotel. And the two managers of the hotel came and sat with us because Narcos was popular back then.
Yeah.
And Joe was there. And Joe sat at the head of this long table. And Javier and I ran so that we could get the seats on both sides of him. People ask us about stories. That's who I want to ask stories
right?
about.
That's,
oh, my goodness.
That's me, too. I'm drawn to it. So it drives me crazy. Because in our industry, and in a lot of industries, like your first responder, your special forces, it seems like it's so hard for people to just say congratulations to somebody else. I may not even like you as a person, but you did a great case.
Yeah.
Or you're tactically sound. I want you in the stack, but you did a great case. And I come up and I go, man, that is an unbelievable case. Congratulations. I'll help however I can. Has nothing to do. Yeah, shit, I don't know. Anyway, but for me, I see people like that. I don't ever go like a Jack Garcia. He's a big man. He came walking through when I was a brand new agent in New York City. And I just saw all these people. And I'm like, what's the scuttlebutt, man? What is it? They go, that's Jack Garcia. That dude is full-time undercover. He does mafia stuff, everything else. And he's a big man, like a 350-pound Cuban. Yeah. I didn't sit over there and go, well, I mean, you know, and I'm like, ooh, I want to meet that guy.
Yeah.
I meet a Mark Horton, big, muscular black guy, sound exactly like Ving Rhames in Pulp Fiction. I don't go, well, he ain't done that. But I go, I want to get some of that. I want to meet that dude and learn.
Exactly.
So I appreciate you saying people. Yeah.
No, man, I love it. I keep referring to your book, and it just hit me. I haven't named it yet. The name of the book is Codename Pale Horse.
Yes.
P-A-L-E Horse, with my country accent. And it continues, how I went undercover to expose America's Nazis.
Yeah.
Now, I found it on Amazon. I think you could probably go to a Simon & Schuster
website. Any bookstore. Be careful on Amazon. I'll hold it up. I got the original galley right here, but that's the cover.
Yep.
It's that cover, but it's usually the top one. I think it's like $21 or something on Amazon. On Amazon, I think Simon & Schuster hits them daily. There are scams. Like, it'll be Codename Pale Horse, my book with my face. The one below, it'll be like Agent Pale Horse workbook, how I did this for $11, and they've taken AI and made my face older, and just don't pay attention to those. There's no workbook. It's just Codename Pale Horse.
Yeah.
I did the audiobook, so it's my voice.
Yep. I started to call you when I saw that. Which book do I get? But I figured it out. Former trained criminal investigator.
Right.
Other things that you're involved with now, public speaking, you spoke at the Eradicate Hate Global Summit in 22 up in Pittsburgh. You're teaching, you've done field production security, and you're an armorer. Is that right?
Yeah, I was on a movie set. I was the armorer, and I helped the prop girl with all the guns. I was actually taking knives and dremeling them down because it was a scene where a dog had to get stabbed. Pretty cool stuff, but that was before Rust happened, the movie Rust shooting. And I remember going on the set, and I remember the director was like, hey, we've got some real 45 rounds over here. And I said, no, you don't.
Yeah.
And they're like, what? And I go, that's okay. These are prop guns. And I said, listen, I'll walk if that's what you want. And that's fine. I said, but there is absolutely zero reason to have a live round on this set. I said, right. I know you say that's a prop gun, but I'm going to tell you that prop gun has a firing pin in it.
Yep.
If you put a real bullet in it and that firing pin hits the primer of that real bullet, I don't know if it's going to be a Bugs Bunny cartoon scene, but something's going to happen.
Yep. Exactly right.
And then about 3 months after we wrapped shooting, within like 3 months, Rust happened and my phone was getting lit up. But yeah, I've done that. I still speak a lot. I'm an alert instructor, which is the national standard for training law enforcement on active shooter response. But most of my time is either being an alert instructor or doing this book tour, and I'm speaking at all kinds of conferences and stuff.
And by the way, your book is a New York Times on the bestseller list, yeah, right?
I forgot to say that. Yes, sir. I've been blessed. That was, and that's pretty quick, right? My book came out March 25th, and I'm already a New York Times bestselling author.
Congratulations, man. That's fantastic. If you want to find more out about Mr. Scott Payne here, you can find him on Instagram at Scott Payne Big Country. And the Payne is P-A-Y-N-E. On Facebook, I couldn't find an account for you, but if you type in Scott Payne Undercover, yeah, you'll see a lot of clips. On X, it's Scott Payne Big Country. On LinkedIn, Scott Payne, and then just look for the words Big Country. You don't have a website, right?
Yet, no, I haven't thought about it, but I hadn't done it yet. Because, I mean, you can just hit YouTube and Google me or search me on YouTube. But it's getting there. We'll see. Some people are talking about it on YouTube channel, this, that, and the other, but currently, my agent with CAA is kind of walking this baby around. So maybe we'll strike and have some
CAA
success.
CAA is number one.
They are. Yeah. Again, I'm blessed. I mean, I've got friends that have done books, and then you got haters. They're like, somebody's approached me for a book. I said, listen, I hope the best for you. But you're just showing me you have no idea what you're talking about, because you can write a book. That does not mean you're going to get Simon & Schuster, and it definitely doesn't mean you're going to get Joe Rogan. Yep. And it's coming from a humble place for me, man. I've been blessed, and I'm just trying to do right by my family, the Lord, and keep paying it forward. I bleed blue, man.
I'm with you on that. So before we finish off here, any last words of wisdom or advice you got for anybody, especially maybe those going into law enforcement or thinking about it?
Kind of like what I think we talked about it offline. Number one, don't tarnish the badge. It takes is a few, and then the rest of everybody pays.
One of the sayings we have here on the Game of Crimes, and it's in your book, is nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
Yeah, absolutely. We do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Trust me, it's hard. I get it. Sometimes I'd much rather throat punch somebody than to do the right thing. But you do it because it's the right thing to do. You take an oath. But I'll end it on this, man. If you're a first responder, and I tie military in with that, we are number one in suicide. We're number one in divorce. We're number one in alcoholism, which you can tie pills and anything else you want to in there now. And we're usually number one for dying within 5 years after retirement. So who signs up for that? So it is still a calling. It's something I still believe in. I wouldn't change anything, but just know that if you get there and you need help, I get not talking to the psychologist at the department or the sheriff's office because you don't want nothing to leak. You can go somewhere else. You can talk to another counselor. You can find a psychologist. And if it doesn't work, Steve, as I said to you, have you ever had food poisoning?
Yep.
Did you quit eating?
Heck no.
There you go. So if you have a bad experience, go. And as I say to a lot of type A personalities, I get it. We don't want to, this means I'm weak. No, it doesn't. That person sitting over there with a toolbox full of tools you don't even know about, go get some training, talk to somebody, let them give you some better tools so you can be even better at what you're doing. And last, keep your family and your sanity and your mental health and your health overall.
Yep. And ladies and gentlemen, you just heard it from somebody who's been there and done that. We didn't talk about the second time he had the crash, and the consequences of that was his wife had to go through some counseling with him. But you're still married today.
Yes, I am. Right?
Still got your family together. Read where your daughters are. Yeah, I'm not real crazy about that school they went to in Alabama, but you know, if it'd been University of Alabama, then we'd be okay with that other one down there. But it's like you said, you do you and I do me.
Yeah.
Please go get this book. Help the guy out. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. I read the book and it's about 254 pages, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
You can read it in a matter of hours because it's one of those, and I say this all the time, it's because of the great guests we bring on here. It's one of those books you just start reading and you don't want to put it down. I start reading books on the plane and I can usually get through halfway on a book on a trip if it's, you know, more than a couple hours. I'm not a real fast reader, but.
You're faster than me.
I tell you what, man, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show here, Game of Crimes. This guy's been on Joe Rogan. You know, Joe would like to be as big as Game of Crimes. He's still working on that, but that's the biggest in the world, ladies and gentlemen. So, and I think your interview, how many hours was it?
Right at 3.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right, I know he does some marathons on there.
Yeah, he was in a hurry that day, but I'm imagining a follow-up at some point.
Yeah. But go check Scott out. thank you so much for coming back. One more plug on YouTube. If you haven't gone over there and checked Game of Crimes out, do me a favor, go to the search bar, type in Game of Crimes podcast, hit the subscribe button, and help me keep the show running. I have no plans to shut this show down. I'm having a blast. We're to the point now, Scott, where people call me with suggestions on great heroes, military, law enforcement, and occasionally I even bring on former bad guys on here.
Yeah.
Just so our listeners get to hear the other side of that thin blue line.
I'm friends with former bad guys. I'm friends with former bad guys from this book that hit me up after I was on Joe Rogan on Instagram. And now we have rekindled our relationships and we are thick as thieves. Pardon the pun.
You still selling them stolen cigarettes?
No. But I may have a pack or two still in my truck from the days. And that's just because I kept some for sources. If I was like, what are you, Marlboro Red, Marlboro Light? What are you, Pall Mall?
Gotta be prepared.
Yeah.
That's like your go bag. You gotta have your kit ready.
And I never had anybody out behind a jail tell me that, man, these are stale cigarettes. They're like over 10 years old, easy. They're like, hell, this is good. And I'm like, I was waiting to see if it burned quicker or something, like an old firecracker or something. Yeah. I'm like, no, it still smokes the same.
It's all good. Buddy, thank you, brother. I mean, it's an honor to have you on here. Thank you for your transparency, opening up about everything, the stories about the PTSD and the things that you go through. There's help out there. Everybody, if you're having suicidal thoughts or you're just going through a traumatic event and you don't know who to call, dial 988. That's the National Crisis Hotline here in the United States. There's somebody on the other line. They're 24/7, 365. We know for sure they speak English and Spanish. If they can't help you, they'll put you in touch with somebody that can. Nobody has to go through anything alone, especially if you're having suicidal thoughts. Again, that's 988. All right, Scott, I'm going to let you go, brother. Thank you again. Just can't say thanks enough.
I appreciate it, man.
Thank you for continuing to join me here. I look forward to seeing you next week. But I already know why you come back every week. Just because you want to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's the game of crimes. God bless. See you next week.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.